even through the book of Kings, learning about Solomon as he's taken over from his father David and preparing, and he's purposed to build the temple as God has called him to do. And we're going to see some of that work take place this evening and see how it starts to come together and what it's all going to look like. And you know, it's an amazing thing that Solomon built there in the temple. We'll be reading about all the gold and all the stuff and how spectacular it is. And you know, as I think about that, and I have a picture of it here I'm going to show in a little bit from one of the brochures out in the bookstore, but as I look at that picture and I see all the gold, and I think it's not even in comparison to what heaven's going to be like. You know, and man, you just think about that and just how amazing it's going to be and how beautiful. You know, we can't even imagine. You know, there's that worship song, I Can Only Imagine. You know, and I don't even know if I can do that, you know, and that type of thing. So Solomon builds the temple. Let's look at chapter 6, verse 1. And it says, it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. So in 1 Kings 5:5, we saw that Solomon had purposed to build the temple. He had purposed in his heart to do it. And so here in this chapter, we see him actually beginning the work. He actually starts to take a place. Last week, we learned about where he was getting the supplies from Hiram and all the things that were going to be coming in. And it's rightly been said, though, that the pathway to Bible studies is strewn with good intentions. The good intentions of those who have purposed, but they never begin. You know, they never begin. We have to both purpose as well as begin if we're going to complete the work that God's called us to. We have to get started. We can have all kinds of good intentions. And Alexander the Great was asked, you know, how he began his conquest of the world. And they asked him, and his response was, by not delaying. He just did it. You know, he got started. It did it. And so, what has the Lord shown you today to do? You know, now is the time to begin. Now is the time to begin that. And there, we have all kinds of reasons and excuses not to do it. We can, you know, we argue with God all the time. A lot of times I think of Jacob wrestling with God. And I catch myself wrestling with him once in a while in that same way. And hopefully I let him win before he touches my hip joint and he puts it out of place, you know. But this verse is really an important one in the Old Testament, because chronologically it enables us to fix certain dates in Israel's history. And the dates of Solomon's reign have been quite definitely established through references in other ancient writings. But they were from 971 to 931 B.C. is when Solomon reigned over Israel. But according to this verse, it was in the fourth year of his reign that he began to build the temple, that he got it started. And that would have been around 966 B.C., give or take 4 years or so. You know, there's some talking about the years in the wilderness today, you know, this and that. But, you know, it's not a whole lot. We just know he started. That's the main thing. But so the Exodus took place, though, 480 years earlier, around 1446 B.C., and it started also in the month of Ziv, which is kind of April, May, you know, in the springtime. Interestingly, though, the temple, 430 years later, under Zerubbabel in 536, also began in the second month. And so these, it kind of begins around these same time periods as we look at that and see that, how God... Like I said, I see the consistency of God. He's the same yesterday, day, and forever. And I wanted to talk about that a little later. But, you know, the consistency that God has in his word, it's incredible, you know. Now, verse 2 and 3 says, now the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, his length was 60 cubits, its width 20, and its height 30 cubits. The vestibule in front of the sanctuary of the house was 20 cubits long across the width of the house, and the width of the vestibule extended 10 cubits from the front of the house. So a cubit is around 18 inches. They have two different types of cubits, but usually from the tip of your fingers to your elbow of the average size person, that was how they would figure normally a cubit. And so you kind of get an idea how the size of this as you read about the length of these 60 cubits with 20 and 30 cubits high and all these things here. And so it ends up being at 90 feet and 30 feet by 45 feet is essentially the measurements. And 30 feet is about from that wall to here, you know, in that area. So, you know, you can start to kind of get an idea how big this type of thing was. And so as we get there, that's actually the tabernacle. That's because the tabernacle was half that size. The temple ended up being twice the size of the tabernacle. And so although the temple, it provides for us a good picture of the church in some ways, it really doesn't hold the same significance to the church as the tabernacle. You know, we see that especially in the book of Hebrews, where it portrays Jesus as the tabernacle rather than the temple as the model for us. Well, I believe why? Because the tabernacle was simple. It was simple. The temple was complex, as we're going to read about and see here in a little bit. But for example, while there was one candlestick in the tabernacle, there will be 10 candlesticks in the temple. And you see that in 1 Chronicles 28. It talks about that. But man seems to prize the ornate. He loves the fancy stuff and all the glitter. However, God values the simplicity. He likes the simple. He really is simple. And he has simple truths for us. He has a simple way to get to heaven. And sometimes people just try to complicate it so much more than it is. But the beautiful truths of the tabernacle portrayed were somewhat masked by the complication and the ornamentation that came along with the temple. It kind of lost some of the simplicity and some of the beautiful truths that were held with the tabernacle. And so we can pick up on that a little bit later and see what I'm talking about there. I brought this brochure up, and it's called the Temple, but there's one out there on the tabernacle too, but you can kind of compare them, but can't see this real well, but all this gold in there, in this temple that Solomon put together, and the area, and we're going to talk about all these. We're going to talk about these three little storerooms in a little bit, and on, we'll break that down for you, but that kind of gives you an idea. But if you want a comparison of the temple and the tabernacle, you can just check out those little brochures out there, and one's on the tabernacle, one's on the temple, and you get a kind of an idea, and it kind of helps hold that. But verse 4 says, "And he made for the house windows with beveled frames. The tabernacle had no windows because the Shekinah glory of God provided the light for the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle. Here, however, there's windows built in the temple." They were high up on the wall. You can see them in this picture here. But they were put there evidently because the plans for the temple provided for failure in case God's glory would not be present there. So it's kind of like this man has this way of realizing. I think Solomon maybe had this insight to know that he needed windows because maybe God's glory would leave. As we know, it eventually had to. And then verse 5 says, "Against the wall of the temple, he built chambers all around against the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctuary. Thus he made side chambers all around it." Again, we see the tabernacle was mobile, built for a journeying nation, built for a nation that was on the move. The temple, on the other hand, was stable. It was built for people who had arrived at their destination. So as the Jewish people were in the wilderness, there was a tabernacle, they were journeying through there, but then now there was a temple. And of course today there is no temple because we're just journeying through this land. We're just here temporarily. We're immigrants here. Our home is in heaven. We haven't arrived at our destination yet. This is just temporary, so we don't need the temple as they did at that time. Then verse 6 says, "The lowest chamber was 5 cubits wide, the middle was 6 cubits wide, And the third was 7 cubits wide. For he made narrow ledges around the outside of the temple so that the support beams would not be fastened into the walls of the temple. And so there's this narrow chelestery windows where evidently, like I say, there were high up on the walls above these 3 stories of these side rooms that surrounded the temple on 2 or 3 sides of the temple that time. And so then there's the temple's main hall and what would have been the inner sanctuary, where the holy place and the most holy place respectively were found. The structure around that building was built against the outer sides, kind of came up against and perhaps even on the back of the temple there at that point. And so this structure was probably about 25 to 30 feet high. It was divided into, like I say, 3 stories, and they had these side rooms, each of which were about 7.5 feet tall on the inside of those rooms. And these rooms, like I say, they were used by the priest for storage. They were there, and you can kind of see it in this picture here. Like I say, it's these 3 rooms here. And we're going to talk about this top one's smaller, bigger, and the biggest one's on top. And that's because of the stairways, which we'll talk about here. But so these are there. They're about there. And these rooms were, like I say, they were used for storage. They were rooms. The rooms were smallest on the first floor, and because it contained these hallways and staircases, get into the second, which makes sense. The larger on the second floor was about 9 feet wide, with some space also given to halls and stairs. But then the largest was on the third floor. It was about 10.5 feet wide. So you have these progressively getting bigger as you go up. And so the offset ledges were apparently the supports for the upper floor. These were built into the walls of the surrounding structure. They really weren't built into the temple itself. And so all of these measurements are probably inside measurements. And I'm going to get to something pretty soon that we can apply. So hang with me a little bit here. Verse 7, it's like, okay, they're building this temple. All right, well, we've got to get through the verses, right? You can't skip it. Verse 7 says, "And the temple, when it was being built, was built with stone finished at the quarry, so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard in the temple while it was being built." Okay, now we get somewhere. In other words, all of the cutting, all of the carving, all of the chipping and grinding was done in the quarry. Amen. So that when these massive stones arrived to be put together at the temple site, they all fit together perfectly. They just laid right on each other there. And, you know, if you see the pictures of the Western Wailing Wall now, you can see these huge stones. And you see over the years, they keep putting these prayer requests into them and stuff. So it's got a little gaps in some of them now. But originally you couldn't put nothing in there because it was just so tightly, so amazingly, perfectly fit together. What amazing sight it must have been. Just to watch this temple going up silently. You know, to be there close by and just look over and not hear a hammer, not hear a chisel, and pretty soon these big, huge stones on top of one another. It's kind of like if you've ever driven by a construction site and you see people working there for weeks and a couple of months and nothing seems to be happening. And then the next morning you drive by and all the walls are up. Well, it's because they poured those walls on the ground, and they're called tilt-ups, and they come into the crane and one day, and they take these big concrete walls, and they just put them up, and then they hook them together. And so it's kind of that same thing there, looking and thinking about this temple, just silently being put together as you would drive by a building that's being put up with tilt-up walls. And it seems like, man, it wasn't there. Now it's just, boom, overnight. Well, because that's the way they do it. And so, but here's the interesting part. Turn, if you would, to the New Testament. Hold your place there or mark it somewhere. Go to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. We get to this point, I just have to go here because it is so applicable to our lives today and to the church especially. 1 Peter chapter 2. Did I say chapter 5? 1 Peter chapter 2, and we're going to I want to start in verse 4. 1 Peter chapter 2 in verse 4 says, coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. Verse 5, you also, that's us, as living stones are being built up to a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices, how acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. That's an amazing verse there. When you really take some time and look at that verse and see what it's saying there, we are those living stones. We're being built up, you know, as that royal priesthood to offer our spiritual sacrifices. See, the temple was there to be able to come so they could offer sacrifices to God for the atonement of their sins. Well, Jesus, through Jesus Christ, we already have that. We already have that. But like it says, we offer up these spiritual sacrifices. They're acceptable to God because of what Jesus did, not because of anything we've done or could do. They're acceptable through him. So we're these living stones. And so what does that make the world? It makes the world around us the quarry. That's our rock quarry. And so we're living in that rock quarry. The world and the earth is the place where we're chipped and cut. The world is where we get polished and ground so that when we get to heaven, the clamor will cease. The clamor will cease. The work will be completed. Right now, we're still going through that work. We're still getting chipped away. But for now, this life is the quarry. This life is a quarry, and which explains why we feel like we're being chipped and chiseled a lot. You know, and then, you know, sometimes we can ask, why am I next to this blockhead? You know, why are they a part of my family? Wow. Now, you know why. Because as living stones, we are constantly being rubbed together with one another, knocking off the rough edges off of one another in the process. He's knocking us together. I always like to use the analogy of cinder blocks. And if you've ever seen a bricklayer laying a block wall, they've got their mud there that they're putting on, and they got their pile of bricks, and they're reaching over, and they put it on, and grab another one, they put it on, they level it out. Well, every once in a while, they'll grab one that didn't come out of the form just right, and it'll have a big corner left on it. And so what do? They don't put it off the side and not use it. No, they pick up another brick, and they knock them together. And as they knock that together, it takes off that little burr on the end of it. And then they set it on that wall, and it's nice and level. And that's what God's doing with us. He's chipping away at us. And so, you know, that's why we're being, our rough edges are getting rubbed off of one another. And the problem is, you know, we all like to get away from the blockhead that we're rubbing up against. It's just normal self thing, you know. But because God puts us next to those people to fix the fix in us, he puts us with these people in situations he knows will shape us effectively and make us who we need. So if I try to fix the fix, then God will put me in another one, because he'll be faithful to put me in another fix to fix the fix that he wanted to fix in the first place. Now we're confused, huh? But that's what God is for. And so when we get to this place about the quarry, and they did the chipping, they did the grinding away in the quarry, so when they got those stones to the temple, they fit together. See, if we don't learn this, we'll go from fix to fix until finally we get to the place where we say, okay, Lord, I'm not going to try to fix this or wiggle out of that, but I'm going to embrace and accept where you have me, because I know you're doing a work on me, shaping me for eternity. We get to that place after long enough. We butt heads with somebody long enough. But unfortunately, a lot of times we don't stick with one another long enough to do it. You know, unfortunately, you see it a lot in marriages today. You know, things don't go just right. Oh, we're out of here. You know, but that's not what God would desire. Philippians 1:6 says, being confident of this very thing, he that has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Christ Jesus. He's going to complete that work. He started it in us. He's going to complete it. And as we've seen Solomon purposed in his heart to build the temple, now we see him start to begin it. And so we have to begin that work. And you know, it's not always how you start, though. It's how you finish. We need to finish the race as well. And so he's going to complete that work for us. Excuse me. So now let's pick it up in verse 8 through 10. Get back to some measurements. The doorway for the middle story was on the right side of the temple, and they went up the stairs to the middle story, and from the middle to the third. So he built the temple and finished it, and he paneled the temple with beams and boards of cedar. And he built side chambers against the entire temple, each 5 cubits high, and they were attached to the temple with cedar beams. So the temple actually faced east, but the entrance to the surrounding structure there in verse up in verse 5 was on the south. That's where the entrance to that was. The side rooms on all the floors were connected by internal staircases and passageways. You know, I thought about that. I thought they were all on the inside. You go in, and that's where you stay. You stay where he puts you. You stay in that temple there. You've got all access on the inside. There's no reason to go out. There's no reason for us to even think about going back to the world. You know, there's no reason to go back. There's nothing there. You know, the answer isn't there. And so sometimes when we get in a little bit of a bind or a little crisis, it's easy for us to think we have to return back. But, you know, the New Testament is like a dog returning to his vomit. You know, there's nothing there. And all of these rooms were connected on the inside. There was an internal way to get there, to stay on the inside. So though no beams of the side structure were actually inserted into the temple walls, the inner walls and the side rooms were attached to the temple, it says, by cedar beams. And so, you know, just use some good wood. Everything was the top of the line, and it was all connected together. And then verse 11 says, then the word of the Lord came to Solomon, saying, concerning this temple which you are building, if you walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep all of my commandments, and walk in them, then I will perform my word with you, which I spoke to your father David. And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people Israel. So here it is, the construction's going on, and even while the construction is going on, the Lord calls Solomon back. He calls him back to a very important reality. He kind of gives him a wake-up call. In the midst of building this project, he says, walk in my statutes, execute my judgments, keep my commandments, and then I will perform my word. In other words, the Lord was saying, I'm not so concerned about the building, but I'm concerned about building you. I'm concerned about building up you. And so don't ever mistake a lot of activity in ministry for what is happening spiritually internally. We all need that check and balance. We all need that place where we come to and realize, you know what, how am I in Jesus? How am I in Jesus today? You could be buzzing around doing all kinds of things for the Lord, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're doing them well. I want to get to heaven and hear, well done, good and faithful servant. I want to make sure I'm doing them right. So how are you doing, you and the Lord doing? How are you and the Lord doing? You know, that's just kind of a check here. God gives Solomon this check in the middle of all this construction going on. All these things are taking place. And the Lord comes to Solomon and says, hey, buddy, are you talking to me still? Are you seeking me for that wisdom that you wanted? Are you really looking to me, or are you just busy doing all the stuff? So where are you in the Lord today? That's the issue. And that's always the issue. That's the main thing, is where we are with Jesus. Later, Solomon's disobedience resulted in God's removing part of the nation from the control of his son Rehoboam because of his disobedience. God also promised that if Solomon obeyed the Lord, his nation would enjoy God's fellowship and protection. That was a promise. Israel experienced that only partially. Only partially because of Solomon's later apostasy. And as we saw that as we went through Ecclesiastes, we saw what place he got to and how far away he got. And so he didn't keep this. He didn't stay in check with God in that way. He didn't continue on. He got busy. He got his focus on so many other things. As we read about in Ecclesiastes, man, he looked for, you know, knowledge and psychology and all this stuff. He was looking everywhere for pleasures and for riches, and he started getting his focus on all that stuff instead of keeping his focus right on Jesus, as he should have done. And so it's easy. You know, it's easy that, you know, we have our jobs, we have our families, we have things going on, and it's easy to get distracted by the world. It just really is. But that's why it's so important to start your day with Jesus in mind. To start your day and say, God, I want to give our day to you. Father, direct us, provide for us, keep us safe, give us wisdom. You know, to pray for the wisdom of Solomon. Wow. You know, and to start that day that way, so that way when you bump into something, it doesn't destroy you. You're kind of like a bumper car. You bump off and you go on down the track. You keep on going. So Israel, they didn't experience all of God's blessings because of Solomon's apostasy and where he got to. And so that should be a lesson, I believe, for us to really realize and be aware of just how easy it really is. And then verse 14 says, so Solomon built the temple and finished it. And he built the inside walls of the temple with cedar boards. From the floor of the temple to the ceiling, he paneled the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the temple with planks of cypress. Then he built the 20-cubit room at the rear of the temple from the floor to the ceiling. With cedar boards, he built it inside as the inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. And in front of it, the temple sanctuary was 40 cubits long. The inside of the temple was cedar carved with ornamental buds and open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone to be seen. You know, you just get this idea of this beautifully ornate place, man. And the work and the detail, the flowers and the gourds and the different things that, you know, inscripted in the gold. You know, it's just amazing. So the entire interior of the temple first was covered with these cedar boards on the wall and then with pine boards on the floor, but they were all overlaid with gold. Man, it's just amazing. The main hall in front of the inner sanctuary, or the most holy place, it was actually the most holy place. This is where the Ark and the Covenant would sit. And we'll talk to that in a minute. But that's where the presence of God would dwell for them. And so the main hall was 60 feet long. It was twice the length of the most holy place. And the interior, like I say, was decorated with these carved gourds and flowers. It had to be beautiful. Then verse 19 says, and he prepared the inner sanctuary inside the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. And the inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold and overlaid the altar of cedar. So Solomon overlaid the inside of the temple with pure gold. He stretched gold chains across the front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. And the whole temple he overlaid with gold until he had finished all the temple. Also, he overlaid with gold the entire altar that was by the inner sanctuary. Wow, again, just all this gold, all this overlay. And so the Ark of the Covenant now is the only thing that we find in the temple that was part of the tabernacle. That is there because this is as it should be, because the Ark represented the presence of God. And God in Christ Jesus is, like I said earlier, is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so that Ark of the Covenant was the one thing that remained from the tabernacle end of the temple. All the other stuff was new and different and changed away, and there was more, like I say, of the candles instead of what was in the temple. And so there were just a whole lot of changes, but there's no change in God. Like I say, He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. God's Word doesn't change. Excuse me, because God's Word is truth. And the truth never changes. And so that's part of all of that. And so inside this most holy place, like I say, a 30-foot cube, all overlaid with gold. This was the Ark of the Covenant there, inside of this place. The altar of cedar was the altar of incense. It was located in the holy place there as well. And so Solomon's incense altar was made of cedar, but it was overlaid, like I say, with gold. And it was also called the Golden Altar. And then he talks about these gold chains that hung in the holy place across the doors that led into the most holy place. These golden chains. You know, everything. The more you read about this, it just blows me away. You know, I think about it and I think, you know, to walk up and they're golden chains. You know, you go to the theater and they have the little Disneyland lines, you know, and they're plastic things or these straps going across. Imagine gold ones, you know, laying out there, you know, just what a different feel that would have, huh? And so it's all there. They're all overlaid with this gold chains hung into the most holy place. 1 Kings 6:22 kind of repeats a part of what was stated in verses 14 through 21 about the altar and the incense altar all located in the holy place there. So it kind of repeats back there. Then verse 23 says, inside the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, even 10 cubits high. One wing of the cherubim was 5 cubits, and the other wing of the cherub at 5 cubits, 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. And the other cherub was 10 cubits. Both cherubim were of the same size and shape. The height of the one cherub was 10 cubits, and so was the other cherub. Then he set the cherubim inside the inner room, and they stretched out the wings of the cherubim so that the wing of the one touched the wall, and the wing of the other, the cherub, touched the other wall. And their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. And he overlaid the cherubim with gold. And so here are these cherubim that they were these sculptured angels carved from olive wood for the temple. Their wings were spread out so that side by side they extended 30 feet. Like I say, from here to about the wall over there is 30 feet. So you imagine, see how big this was, how large it was. And they were extended from the north to the south walls of the most holy place. And gold covered them. Gold covered them too. And the cherubim were much larger in the temple than they were in the tabernacle. But unlike in the tabernacle, the cherubim were solid gold. Here they're just gold overlaid. And so they're gold plated, so to speak. And so there was a difference in them in that respect. And then verse 29. So then he carved all the walls of the temple, all around both the inner and outer sanctuaries, with carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers. And the floor of the temple he overlaid with gold, both the inner and the outer sanctuaries. For the entrance of the inner sanctuary he made doors of olive wood, and lintel and doorpost were 1/5 of the wall. Man, big doorpost. The two doors were of olive wood, and he carved on them figures of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and overlaid them with gold. And he spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. So for the door of the sanctuary, he also made doorposts of olive wood, 1/4 of the wall. And the two doors were of cypress wood. Two panels comprised one folding door, and two panels comprised the other folding door. Then he carved cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers on them, and he overlaid them with gold, applied evenly on the carved work. And so the walls of the inner and the outer rooms of the most holy place and the holy place respectively were decorated with these carved cherubim, palm trees, and what's called open flowers. In other words, they weren't budding, they were opened up, they were there. And so the olive wood doors leading from the holy place, it says, were framed with 5-sided frames. Some commentators believe that they were actually sliding doors. I don't have no way of knowing that for sure, but the doors leading from the porch to the main hall, or the holy place, were made of pine at that, but they were overlaid with gold. And then they hung on four-sided jambs and were probably a bifold, and having each of the two leaves were hinged together, so when they folded open, the leaves opened up. You know, so it just kind of, again, just a spectacular little detail as they turned on their sockets and pivots point. When they would open, they would close, and when they closed, they would be open. And so you kind of see all the doors were decorated just like the walls. So it's just, wow. You know, again, just amazing when you start to think of the detail and the amount of the value in that as well. And then verse 36 says, "And he built the inner court with three rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams." And so the inner courtyard was an open plaza surrounding the temple. There was also this outer court, not mentioned here, but it's mentioned in 2 Chronicles 4:9. And this was somewhat of in lower in elevation than was the inner court, or what the upper court was. And you can read about that also in Jeremiah 36:10. It talks about the lower and the upper. The inner courtyard, also called the courtyard of the priest, that was for them in 2 Chronicles 4:9. It tells us that was separated from the outer, or the great court, by the walls described here. These walls that are being described, that was a separation point from that. And so this wall consisted of three courses or three rows of dressed or cut stone, limestone for one course or one row, of cedar beams also on that. So the outer courtyard was surrounded by a wall as well. And the size of the inner courtyard is really not given here. But if the dimensions of the courtyards of the temple are proportionate to those with the tabernacle courtyard, then as the dimensions of the temple were, the tabernacle structures in the inner courtyard, it would have been about 150 feet if they would have been proportionate to what the tabernacle was. And so most of the temple was built, you know, a little bit larger, and so it would have been 150 feet wide and 400 feet long. So again, it's huge, relatively huge place over there as you see that. And you know, I like I say, I have this picture here, but then on the wall back there, there's that frame picture. Now that's Herod's temple, so it's a little bit different than Solomon's temple was, but you get an idea of the magnitude of what happened. Of course, Herod, you know, he was into big things. And so he expanded the whole Temple Mount a little bigger and built all that other stuff over there, larger than that. But even this Solomon's temple was huge, especially when you consider the day and age it was in and the time. And so you think about, you know, I often wonder, you think about coming up from I think it would be Bethany up over the Mount of Olives and come down and see this big, gorgeous temple glistening in the sun. Man, it must have been amazing, you know. So we get to that it's incredible. Then verse 37 and 38. Says, "In the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its details and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years in building it." Okay, 7 years there. It gets confusing with the 11th year and this year and the fourth year, but somehow it was 7 years to build the temple. Yeah, I have to take my shoes off to get the math right, I guess. But so bottom line, a little over seven years probably in building the temple from the fourth year of Solomon's reign to his 11th year. I guess that's where they figure it out. They get to it at that. And so more precisely, it probably would have been about 7.5 years. Ziv, like I say, is April and May. Bul is the 8th month, would have been October and November. So from there, so probably around 7.5 years to do all of this work and to get it there. And so this would have been a massive thing, realizing they didn't have cranes. You know, they didn't have all the modern things. I mentioned that tilt-up wall. I mean, you know, when they pour the concrete on those tilled-up walls, they put two little pins in a particular place. When the crane comes in, it picks up and it latches onto those two pins, and it picks up that concrete wall like it's a piece of paper. You know, and it's amazing to see that happen. And I worked on one of those buildings years ago, and it was for the Salvation Army over on North Las Vegas. And so Salvation Army had their foundation poured to be the certain size for their warehouse. And so we'd already poured the walls on that foundation. Well, some more finances came in because God blessed it. And so they wanted to extend that foundation out. Well, the wall we poured for that end meant it needed to go on the end of that wall. So when it was time to raise that wall after they extended it, the crane had to come down, pick up that wall, and literally take it down another 15, 20 feet to where it would stand. And I remember watching that wall just amazing. I thought, it's incredible what machines can do. But you think about this, they did it without machines. Oh, yeah, they did it with the power of God working in them and all the men that it took and to put this together and stuff. So as we look at the building of the temple, like I say, a lot of it's like, well, all these measurements and all this stuff and everything else. But, you know, God is a God of details. You know, he likes to be precise. He likes to let us know that he is in control. He's got it all figured out. And so when it comes to our life, there's some things measured out for us. And we need to be open to those. We need to understand that. And so, you know, sometimes some of these things can be seemingly a little dry. The measurements and door sizes and windows and all this stuff. But God puts us together just as amazing. You know, think about our body, you know, the way that he created our bodies and the way that they function. You know, all the cells work together, all the organs work together, everything just comes together in just the right way. And it's just amazing when we think about that and see that taking place. And so when you read some of these things, you know, genealogies are kind of the same way. You know, but when you read some of these, you get an area of this, it's kind of, you know, you look at it and say, oh, so what, you know. I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago, and they were in 1 Kings 2, and he says, yeah, that beginning, that's kind of dry. And I thought, well, yeah, but, you know, when you come to an area like the chipping of the quarry, and you see he's preparing us here now, so that when we get to heaven, it's all done, it's all finished. You know, and he's given us that ability to know that we don't have to work now. We just have to be obedient. You know, justification means it's all been paid for. So praise the Lord. Let him chip away at you and be open if he puts a check in your spirit. Where are you and him at today? Let's pray.